Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. The Central Asian presidents just finished their summit in Dushanbe. The summit came at a time of great uncertainty in Central Asia. The ripple effects from Russia's full-scale war on Ukraine are changing the geopolitical landscape in Central Asia, even as climate change has already started affecting the physical landscape of the region as well. There was certainly much to talk about in Dushanbe. So what did the Central Asian presidents discuss, and what was not discussed during their meeting? Was there any progress at the summit? To discuss all this, I am joined by Edward Lemon, professor at the Bush School in Washington, D.C., and president of the Oxus Society, and Timur Omarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin. Thank you both for joining me. Let's start with the problematic part of this. So the five presidents get together. Last year, they got together in Chulpanatah, and Turkmenistan and Tajikistan did not sign the friendship, a regional friendship agreement for some reason. And apparently, they didn't again. Any thoughts on that? I'll start with you, Timur.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me. I think that, you know, the fact that the consultation meeting mechanism is just emerging has a lot of, you know, different implications on how the things are going between Central Asian countries. And those examples that you are talking about are just the proof that, you know, of course, Central Asian countries, the way we know them, have been existing on the map for more than 30 years. But the processes that are happening, the processes of integration and more cooperation, are just, you know, simply too young and overloaded with obstacles and problems that do not allow them to kind of be showcased as a, signed documents and etc. So I think that's what we should keep in mind when we will be discussing this whole summit.
Okay, great. Thank you. Edward, I'd like to get your thoughts on that too. You know, in the 1990s, every time these guys got together, not all five of them, but you'd get three of them together and they would sign treaties of eternal friendship. And this was happening all the time in the 90s. Why is it so hard for them to sign a friendship treaty, a regional friendship treaty now?
Well, yes, Bruce, I think you're right in saying that in the 1990s, there were various efforts, particularly spearheaded by then Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev, to form, more regional platforms for discussing regional issues. And there was a short-lived Central Asian Union that included four of the five republics minus Turkmenistan as its members. But later on, Russia joined that organization and it subsequently ceased to be functional. So there have been various efforts throughout history for the Central Asian republics to interact amongst themselves without external powers, without Russia, without China, without the United States. And they've always faced barriers, as Timur said, particularly tensions between countries in the region. Historically, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan had very tense relations. More recently, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan have had a number of border conflicts, particularly flaring up in April 2021 and September 2022, which have led to regional tensions. And so I think, you know, this latest summit, although there has been progress, and we can talk about that in terms of trade and investment and security cooperation between the Central Asian republics, I think there's still those lingering distrust and a lack of will on the part of certain countries in the region, certain heads of state in the region, to really invest in building stronger regional ties.
Okay, thanks. Let me get back to you with this question then. Security, of course, this is a perennial when these guys get together. It was when they were meeting in the late 1990s. It has been since they started meeting again 4 or 5 years ago. It's pretty much always centered on Afghanistan. But it seems like, you know, the external threats are not really the threats anymore, right? I mean, it's pretty much domestic or regional, you know, regional, interregional. You mentioned Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, right? Those seem to be the security threats. So what is, when they talk about security threats, what are they talking about now?
Well, I think, as you say, historically, the main unifying external security threat was Afghanistan, discussions over what would happen after the NATO withdrawal in 2021 and how that would affect the region. I think underlying all of this, and we can talk about this maybe later, is the looming threat of Russia. And of course, Russia is concerned that the Central Asian republics don't form too much regional cooperation insofar as it could be a balance against their influence in the region. But I think, Tokayev's statements about the Central Asian republics needing to take more ownership over their regional problems is a sign that this is in part, this regional integration is in part, or certainly going to affect Russia's influence in the region. But in terms of security threats, as you say, a number of the security threats that are regional security threats are posed by different states within the region towards each other. So, of course, discussing those on a regional level is more problematic and more difficult. And we saw, obviously, a meeting between Sergey Japarov, the president of Kyrgyzstan, and Emomali Rahmon, the president of Tajikistan today, or yesterday, in fact, on the 14th. And certainly they talked about the need to delimit borders and build more friendly relations, but I don't see any concrete outputs or outcomes of those meetings.
Okay, yeah, thank you. And also thank you for bringing up the topic of Russia. Timur, I was looking at the speeches that were being given yesterday, you know, Tokayev's speech and Nursultanov's speech and some of what Rahmon said. And I even did a word search on Russia and could not find Russia anywhere. They seem to have done everything they could to avoid even mentioning the name. Is that surprising? Does that tell us anything?
I wouldn't say that it's surprising, actually, because, you know, as we all know, the Russia's presence in Central Asia has been, you know, dominant for many reasons. And this is a fact that even the isolated and weakened Russia still has a lot of interest and a lot of influence in the region. And most importantly, Russian political elites have ties to Central Asian political elites. So I would be surprised if the potential risk from the North would have been labeled as, you know, Russia threat or any problems that have to do with the new circumstances, geopolitical situation, the economic, you know, positioning of Central Asian countries with sanctions, etc., would have been labeled as problems that we have because of Russia. Because Russia has ears in the region everywhere, and I'm sure that even behind closed doors, the presidents and other officials would have been afraid to call the problem by its name. So this is actually not surprising. And it actually shows how kind of difficult and challenging it is for Central Asian countries, even when they are exclusively meeting in the combination without external actors, if we don't consider Azerbaijan to be, you know, someone who is listening to what's being said and then transfers it to Russia. But I'm not sure, this is what kind of Central Asian countries are thinking about. Anyway, it just shows how challenging it is for Central Asian countries, even when they're meeting exclusively by themselves, to, you know, discuss the problems that exist without kind of trying to use a very careful language.
Mm-hmm, thanks. And Edward, I'd like to get your thoughts on that too. Is there some subtext here, or should we read something into the fact that they were afraid to even pronounce the word Russia at this summit?
Well, I think as Timur said, you know, they've often danced around, you know, and a lot of the proclamations and the statements are pretty vague, and the outputs and outcomes of these consultative meetings, of which this is the fifth, you know, this was a process that began in 2018 at the behest of President Mirziyoyev of Uzbekistan. And, you know, since then, if we're honest, although it's positive, I think, for the region that the presidents are meeting to consult with one another on regional issues, there haven't been too many concrete outputs. In fact, you know, the outputs we've seen that have advanced regional cooperation have been more at the bilateral level, you know, agreements to reopen border crossings, visa-free regimes, trade agreements between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan to hold bilateral military exercises, for example. And so I think, you know, this consultative body, which has avoided becoming anything more institutionalized, you know, and it's a very informal platform that meets once a year at the head of state level, has, you know, done so, I think, and adopted that more informal approach because of that concern about how Russia would react to the Central Asian presidents forming their own regional organization modeled on ACN or something like that, which people have talked about as a potential model for all of this. So I think Russia lingers in the background of all of this, but I'm not surprised they don't openly discuss it because, as Timur said, they have important relations with Russia and impact relations. Certain aspects of the relationship with Russia have actually strengthened since the full scale of invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. So certainly Russia remains an important actor.
Okay, thanks. What about border delimitation? Almost all the countries still have some of this process going on right now. Did the Kyrgyz-Tajik conflict kind of sour this? It's now a taboo subject, and we don't bring it up at regional summits.
Well, I think it was in the readout of the meeting between Japarov and Rahmon that they discussed border delimitation, but I don't think there was any, at least from the public messaging, there was any concrete progress in that regard. I think something like a third of that border is still not being fully delimited, and there's still sporadic violence occurring across that border, and those tensions that have flared up and killed, you know, hundreds of people at this point, mostly civilians, continue to exist. And I don't think yesterday's meeting will change that. And I think there's still, unfortunately, a looming threat of conflict on the Tajik-Kyrgyz border.
Is this, and I'll let both of you answer this, but I'll start with you, Edward. Is this kind of surprising? You would think that if there was, you know, people have been trying to figure out who could mediate this. Russia's offered, no one has seemed to have much interest in that. But it seems like this is kind of since it's a regional issue and something that no one in the region wants to have sticking out there, that this would be something that they would possibly, you know, this is a chance to do some mediation or at least offer some help in that. Or why is this so difficult for them? Any thoughts?
Well, I think when there was the most recent, very serious violence on the border, which was just under a year ago in September, late September 2022, Uzbekistan and Shavkat Mirziyoyev said that he was ready to help mediate. And I do think that having a Central Asian mediator, be it Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan or a combination of both, would be the optimal option in terms of external mediators. Obviously, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan are both members of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which counts Russia as its leading member. And Russia has offered and called on sides to moderate their behavior, but ultimately, you know, hasn't been able to really exercise much leverage on this conflict. In fact, the Kyrgyz side largely view Russia as supporting the Tajik side in that conflict, and so they're not viewed as an impartial mediator. And so I think Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan would be better placed, but ultimately they haven't. It would require the consent of the Kyrgyz and Tajik sides, which I don't think has been granted at this point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Timur. Are the other states missing a chance to kind of help ease the tensions between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan? Any reason why they wouldn't suggest maybe that they're open to mediation, or this could be a topic at the summit? Should be a topic at the summit.
I think it would have been a topic of the summit if the summit was really about, if it was specific. Right now, the summit itself, it's called consultative meetings, and it's very vague. It's all over the place. Presidents are talking about everything and nothing at the same time. And most importantly, I think the two parties that have border conflict, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, they themselves don't want anyone to participate in it. And they, I'm actually afraid to say that they themselves don't want to have this issue be resolved, because the resolvement of any conflict, territorial conflict, means that each side should give up land and each side should find compromise, which means that those political regimes that we have in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan that are sometimes lean towards nationalistic rhetoric to gain support of the population, they will have a lot of problems with their stability and with their society. So I'm not sure whether we're talking about a situation where everyone wants to have a, you know, peaceful border, but no one is smart enough to initiate this on the platform. I just think it's just, you know, the will to resolve this problem is not there. And maybe even worse than that, some political regimes use these kinds of conflicts to consolidate popularity among the populations.
Okay, thank you. A minute ago, you mentioned the Azerbaijani president was there. So Ilham Aliyev shows up. Clearly, this for one thing, it helped President Mirziyoyev ease into regional connectivity and transportation routes, and he called for strengthening land routes that go through the area. Takayev had comments that were very similar about this, too. What about the middle corridor? You know, everyone's been touting this since the Russian corridor became the traditional Russian corridor became a lot more complicated to deal with. Can you speak a little bit about the progress in the middle corridor and anything that you saw at the summit that seems to indicate that it's still moving forward?
Yes, I think that one of the most important things that has been discussed during this summit is to ease the infrastructure and logistics inside of Central Asia. So, of course, we're not talking about anything specific or concrete, but it seems that everyone was raising this problem, talking about custom regimes, talking about the visas and different routes and roads, et cetera, so in this regard, the presence of Aliyev, president of Azerbaijan, seems logical, especially considering that, with the war in Ukraine, it has become very difficult to continue business as usual through the Russian territory. And it's just technically very, difficult for companies to spend additional money on insurance, et cetera. And the middle corridor is becoming a growing and more attractive route for specific companies that deal with logistics. But here we should understand that there are several limitations to the middle corridor replacing Russia. First of all, the scale. Till February 2022, almost 80% of the trade between Central Asian countries and Europe would happen through the Russian territory. And it's just impossible overnight or even in 2 years replace this amount of trade by any other route. It's just impossible, and we're not talking here about a complete replacement. We're just talking about adding some additional numbers to the logistics that happens through the middle corridor. Especially it's important for energy routes, and Kazakhstan has been enlarging its presence in the Caspian, so it can export its oil not through pipeline that it has through Russian territory, but through the use of middle corridor. And it has purchased several tankers already, in addition to the five that it already possesses, and with the plan to purchase two more. So there is a growing trend to see the middle corridor as a more safe and stable connection between Central Asia and Europe, but still there is a problem with the investment. You cannot just send tracks or whatever to that route. You have to invest into having special equipment and ships, etc., etc. Azerbaijan also needs investment to process all of the additional trade, etc. So it's growing, but it's too early to say that the presence of Aliyev on Central Asian summit is a proof that the middle corridor is the next logistic hub, as Russia used to be before the war.
Okay, thank you. Edward, I'd like to get your thoughts on the middle corridor, but particularly the relevance of it for Tajikistan. It was a coincidence, obviously, that they were having the summit this year and that Aliyev showed up when they had the summit in Dushanbe. Still, though, symbolically, it says something. Tajikistan, of course, is backed up in the corner of Central Asia. It's probably the least connected of any of the Central Asian countries. We know they opened a new railway route last year that's part of a multimodal route that would link them by road to China, but then by rail all the way across Central Asia into Iran and on to Turkey. How important is connectivity in the middle corridor for a country like Tajikistan?
Well, I think as Timur said, it's important for the entire region. And I think we should keep in the back of our mind that this initial the impetus behind this push towards greater regional integration, which particularly came after Mirziyoyev came to power in Uzbekistan in 2016, was primarily economic. Mirziyoyev came into power and Uzbekistan had adopted quite an isolationist foreign policy and had difficult relations with multiple external powers for many years under the previous president, Karimov. And Mirziyoyev's Central Asia First foreign policy was driven primarily by a desire to overcome some of the challenges of being a landlocked state. And of course, all the states in the region are landlocked, which of course means that their only ability to trade is via overland routes that have all of the difficulties that Timor has discussed in terms of capacity, in terms of existing transport networks, roads, railways, shipping lanes, etc., etc. And so I think countries like Tajikistan, like Uzbekistan, all the countries in the region view the Middle Corridor as a potential way to reduce reliance on the route via Russia. And trade has certainly increased across the Middle Corridor. I think the figures from last year increased over twofold in 2022, but is still far behind the northern route via Russia. And I think the restrictions and limitations that Timor mentioned mean that it's not going, it'll keep on expanding, but it'll take a number of years for it to reach its full potential. So I think it's something that certainly means that Turkey, or is one of the reasons Turkey is more engaged in the region, given its potential role, or its role within the Middle Corridor. It's a reason certainly we have seen increased interactions between Azerbaijan and the Central Asian Republics, and potentially as an area where China would also have interests as it's looking to build its Belt and Road Initiative to link China to Europe. Many of those corridors historically went through Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, but increasingly China is developing ports and other infrastructure capacity in Georgia on the Black Sea and Azerbaijan on the Caspian Sea. And so it's an area in which China also has an interest in developing.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder, we're talking about the recent Central Asia Summit in Dushanbe, and my guests are Timur Umarov, a fellow at Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin, and Edward Lemon, professor at the Bush School in Washington, D.C., and president of the Oxus Society. Edward, let's move on to climate change and the effects. I mean, this was clearly a huge topic for them. And Timur mentioned it's kind of a talk shop, but I mean, this is really a huge problem that's coming up for them. You know, water, for instance. Can you kind of, for sake of our audience, explain the situation with water recently and where we're headed with this and the problems it presents for Central Asia regional cooperation?
Well, I think the region is particularly susceptible to climate change. And in the past year, we've had, at differing times, we've had historic cold weather. In the winter, a very cold snap hit the entire region in January, but then a few months later, we had historically high temperatures, even before spring had begun. We've seen droughts, we've seen various natural disasters, and so I think, you know, the effects of climate change will be and are already becoming very evident in the region. They're driving individuals and farming communities to protest against the central government, particularly during the drought in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan last year. And they're also driving some of these border issues we've been talking about. Certainly, we've seen in some research I've been involved in Batken province on the Kyrgyz side of the border conflict, people saying that they no longer see it as a viable place to live, not only because of the conflict with Tajikistan, but also because of climate change leading to a lack of water, making farming not an option anymore. So we're seeing increasing internal migration within the region. We are seeing increasing conflicts over scarce water resources, particularly water that's shared across borders. So I think, you know, climate change is cross-cutting. It's having economic, social, and security impacts in the region. And so certainly it's, again, part of this agenda, and it's certainly a threat that can only be addressed regionally, right? And it's a transnational issue. So hopefully there can be more progress. But as we've already discussed, this consultative meeting hasn't really produced anything concrete.
So you didn't see anything from the meeting that suggested that maybe they were on the edge of some kind of progress?
I didn't see anything from anything that I read. Maybe Timur saw other evidence. You know, it seems, you know, the agreements that came out and the progress that was made was more in the fields of connectivity and infrastructure, as we said, and in fields of a statement about the adoption of a regional youth policy, for example. But climate, I didn't see any concrete progress on climate change beyond it being on the agenda and something that was discussed.
Okay, thanks. Timur, and your thoughts on climate change, you know, and I want to mention at this point that, you know, we all saw what happened with Kyrgyzstan and the Kirov Reservoir when which is essentially just dried up. But when they informed Kazakhstan that they just didn't have any more water to send to Jambil province, a lot of people connected the semi-border closure that followed within 48 or 72 hours as being Kazakhstan's response to Kyrgyzstan cutting off the water, which doesn't bode too well for cooperation in the future. I mean, how problematic is this going to be? And did you see any reasonable suggestions come out at the summit?
Yes, climate change is a pressing issue. Definitely, it was an important part of the consultative meetings this time. But I agree with Edward that no substantial things have been reached this time, unfortunately. But it's important to say that this meeting on the fund of saving the RLC was something that important, but fact again that Kyrgyzstan is not being represented there on the highest level is sad. Japarov was not present. He sent the first deputy chairman of the government, Yakov there instead of himself. And Kyrgyzstan is not participating in the fund since 2016 because the Kyrgyz government doesn't agree with the overall actions of the fund. And, this time, the Central Asian countries were not successful into dragging Kyrgyzstan back to this format. So I cannot say that the amount of problems that we have in climate are being faced by Central Asian leadership. I just think that Central Asian leadership see ecological and broadly climate problems as something that next generation would have to deal with, and considering that authoritarian regimes tend to be very short-sighted and think about maximum the current presidential term or the nearest 5 years, I think that no one really believes that this would be a problem that might become a main issue for the stability of their political regimes. And I think this is a huge mistake, because even today we see that, the temperatures in Central Asia rise on the record levels, winters are becoming colder, and the consequences are also right there. So we have energy crisis, we have during summers also energy crisis because of the growth of electricity consumption. At the same time, we have a very old infrastructure, energy infrastructure in all five Central Asian countries, and no one has to be putting this as a priority in their domestic politics and in the collaborative efforts between Central Asian countries. So I just think it's not the priority of the current leaderships of Central Asian countries, and that is why we haven't seen anything specific during the summit.
Okay, thanks. And also thanks for bringing up the RLC, because it's worth pointing out that, you know, this was the big environmental crisis in the 1990s. And when they created that fund, they were supposed to do whatever they could to save the RLC when it still was a big body of water. And that failed miserably. So it doesn't give you much hope going forward, I suppose. Okay, let's get down to energy, because this is another big problem they're having in Central Asia. Where is there room for cooperation? Everyone's hurting, as far as we can tell, especially when winter comes. Any breakthroughs, Edward?
I think, as Timor just said, you know, the region has faced protracted energy crises. We had during the cold snap, we had Uzbekistan importing gas for the first time from Russia, despite the fact that it itself is a very large producer of natural gas. And so you know, I think energy and, as Timor said, the confluence of increasing demand for energy as we see population growth and urban development and differing consumption habits, combined with a crumbling infrastructure that is much of which dates back to the Soviet Union, that is not fit for purpose and that is very very inefficient, has resulted in, you know, these blackouts on our electricity grids and shortages and communities being cut off from gas during the height of winter. And so I think certainly there are benefits to integrating energy grids so that they can supplement one another in times of shortage. There are interests in allowing for more gas to be shared within the region, exported within the region. But of course, there's a domestic issue there insofar as, you know, populations of one country during a cold period will want to ensure that their citizens are served first before the citizens of neighboring countries. And so, you know, there's certainly, you know, we've seen changes in gas prices obviously being one of the proximate causes of the events of bloody January 2022 in Kazakhstan, and that led, for example, Uzbekistan to stop exporting gas to China in response to, you know, concerns over the popular reactions to the prospect of exporting gas. So I think there certainly is an interest in more in energy integration, but I think there's a concern that each country should serve its own citizens first before helping neighboring states.
Okay, thank you. Good points there. Timur, you know, we know Kyrgyzstan already has a state of emergency in its energy sector that it imposed at the start of August. It's going to last until the end of December 2026, I think, actually. So it's a 3-year energy state of emergency. Is Kyrgyzstan a canary in the coal mine for Central Asia, so to speak, an example of what other countries in Central Asia can expect to have happen in the coming years?
Yes, the state of emergency itself sounds very dramatic and catastrophic, but as far as I understand, the government implemented this not because the situation is kind of crucial or, you know, catastrophic, or if the government wouldn't have done it, we would have seen a kind of huge problems in Kyrgyzstan, but rather it gives this state of emergency gives government more powers when it comes to giving or changing the owners of different assets in energy industry. So I think it's more about money rather than the crisis in energy itself. But if we talk about energy cooperation in Central Asia, you see Central Asia's infrastructure and the whole economies in the first place during Soviet times was built as integrated. Central Asian countries actually are pretty much even today integrated and co-dependent. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, all of the countries had to come up with, you know, like, first of all, there was an emergency of political elites who wanted to have their financial incomes. They were thinking about their own well-being rather than the well-being of the whole populations. And it was in their favor to become more independent and more kind of isolated in a way from other Central Asian countries, so that it would have allowed them to do whatever they want inside of their economies. And till today, we still have these two contradictory factors in Central Asia's, actually any sphere that you might think of, and energy is one of those. Countries' infrastructure is codependent, but at the same time, you have leaderships of those countries who are not interested in being dependent on their neighbors. And I think in this situation, it's very difficult to talk about any integration or reintegration, if you want, because no one really wants to have it unless the situation is very brutal and damaging for the stability of the country. And that's why after the energy crisis, only after the energy crisis, we saw that Uzbekistan for the first time started to talk about stopping export to China of its natural gas and importing more gas from Russia, importing gas from Turkmenistan. You see, I think in Central Asia, unfortunately, with the current political regimes, we have to go through a very challenging crisis, and only after that some of the decisions would have been made to make systems of energy of Central Asian countries more integrated with each other. But if we will not go through those crises, no one will go to this direction.
Okay, thanks. And I got one more quick question before we get to final comments, which is, if you're in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, and for years, you know, people have been telling you your hydropower potential is barely tapped, and, you can be a huge exporter of electricity. Given the climate change, are those days over? Timur?
I'm not a climate change expert. I don't know, but I still do believe that, you know, we don't have the complete kind of situation where Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan have no water resources on their territories. And especially when we speak about the modern technologies of using hydropower, I'm sure they're not as damaging to the flow of the rivers as they used to be during Soviet times. So I'm still pretty sure that when we speak about green economy and alternative energy, Central Asia is the region that is potentially, you know, potentially looks good for investors from objective geographical reasons, but from political reasons and from the reasons that consider the level of corruption and transparency, Central Asia looks pretty bad. And that's why I don't think that many investors are looking at Central Asian region with interest.
Thank you. Edward, what about Tajikistan? You know, they've also been banking on hydropower. Rogun, they're still finishing it up. Will there be enough water for Rogun for 20, 30 years, do you think?
Well, as you said, Rogun has been planned for many years. In fact, since the 1970s, it was first proposed. And now half of the turbines are now online, and so it's producing energy. It's still not completed. It's difficult to say when it may finally, or if it may finally be completed towards the end of the, probably towards the end of the decade. My understanding is that in the shorter term, it's viable, but in the longer term, you know, there are, given glacial melt and glacial retreat that's been taking place in the country, we are expecting lower levels of water, or lower amounts of water to be flowing through, you know, the region's great rivers, the Sirdarya and the Amudarya, in the next 20 to 30 years. So I think certainly placing all of the country's energy into hydropower alone is, of course, something that may not, it will sustain itself through the natural life of the current president, who's just about to turn 71. But looking into the future generations, I think there certainly are questions around the extent to which both Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan can rely on hydro power.
Okay, thanks. And final thoughts, Timur. What did you see? Anything big come out of this summit, or are we still at the level where it's enough that there are five of them are getting together and talking?
Yeah, unfortunately, actually, the fact that they met is already a success, and the fact that they met for the fifth time, it's also something to be satisfied with, I guess. I don't have high expectation, and I didn't have them before the summit happened. So I do believe that rituals in foreign policy matter, and seeing the emergence of this ritual of five leaders meeting every year, and with them all of the high-ranking officials of all five Central Asian countries getting to meet each other, discuss many different things, maybe even, you know, creating ties and creating friendship with each other, I think it's a good tendency.
Okay, thank you. Edward, do you see anything notable come out of this summit in Dushanbe?
I think, as Seymour said, the positive was that we had all the presidents there. Not all of these five meetings have included all of the presidents. It's important to see Sardar Berdimuhamedov, who became took over from his father in Turkmenistan in early 2022, attending and being more engaged regionally. I don't think moving away from permanent neutrality anytime soon, but certainly increasing the country's international engagements. It was important to see Japarov there, even though he left early, as we discussed. And I think, you know, maybe the most notable development was President Aliyev of Azerbaijan attending. Now, certain Azerbaijani commentators saying this is now a new C5 plus one, if we didn't already have enough of those in the region. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Azerbaijan continues to attend. But I think, you know, if the development of the Middle Corridor is going to become a focal point, then there would be the need to perhaps also include Georgia, whose leaders very infrequently meet with any of the Central Asian presidents. And so I would say those are the main outcomes. I don't think we saw anything dramatic. I think, as Timor said, it was important. It's important symbolically that these meetings are taking place and that things are being discussed. But, you know, there were no concrete outcomes of this meeting that will transform any of the issues that we've been discussing today. So I think it's a positive sign, but, you know, more concrete outcomes are definitely desirable for the region.
Okay, great. Thank you. You know, and of course, potentially all five of these guys are getting together again next week in New York. So I haven't heard about Berdimukhametov, but we might hear more from them very soon. So thank you, Edward, and thank you, Timur, for being on the program. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.